Welcome to Old Money, a show dedicated to helping you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. Ladies who lunch, listen up. Life is not about looking rich. I want you to build a life and a legacy that feels rich in every sense of the word. If you're ready to stack cash, talk shop, and trade insider secrets, you're in the right place. These are the new rules to old money. So let's get after it. Hello, rich girls. Welcome back to Old Money, the podcast to help you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. I am your host, Amber Frankhuizen, and today's episode might be my most favorite that I have ever researched. If I were a PhD, a doctorate, a professor of some sort, there's only one topic that I know with confidence I would crush. I'm talking about writing papers, being featured as Time's Person of the Year because I'm so good at my craft, ringing the bell at the New York Stock Exchange, all because of my experience, my depth of knowledge, and my dedication to understanding the inner workings of reality television, more specifically, Bravo. I always joke that I have a PhD in Bravo, and I actually probably should. So Andy Cohen, if you're listening, I will accept an honorary doctorate and or an advisory role on anything that you have going on. On today's episode, I am breaking down some of the most complicated financial topics and concepts by relating them back to the things that we have seen our favorite Bravo stars go through. And not only are we going to be talking about the concepts, I'm going to be spilling the tea on everything you've ever wanted to know financially related to the television show Bravo. Now, today's episode is actually inspired by my friend Shannon Weinstein, who is the founder and fractional CFO mastermind behind her business, Keep What You Earn. We're definitely having Shannon on the show in Q2. I cannot wait for you guys to meet her and hear from her. Number one, she's hysterical. Number two, she's so smart. But number three, the reason why today's episode is inspired by her is because she is the master. The mistress, the master mistress, the best in the world at breaking down financial topics using stories or analogies or examples to make it really digestible. She is all about jargon-free finance, which I love. Her role, by the way, is to support business owners in different capacities, mostly in fractional CFO services. This is just a free commercial for Shannon because I love and respect her so much. She's also, full disclosure, a current client of AF Marketing, but she's a friend of mine first. We met in a mastermind many years ago, and I've just followed her career. She has a podcast called Keep What You Earn, and if you have a business, like, you need to go listen. She breaks everything down. She releases so many episodes. And because she is the queen of analogies, she was inspiring me to think, how can I make these topics that I want to talk about easier to understand or just digest? Because I think once we have an anchor to a problem, to a topic, to anything at all, and we can start to contextualize it, that's when we really start to learn and embody the material. One of the biggest things that I found in my career, for example, like when I first started working in real estate development, I'd go into these meetings and they'd be talking about like type 4 construction or caissons or IRR. And I didn't know what IRR was enough. That was a construction term. Like, I didn't know what type 4 construction was. And IRR, by the way, is internal rate of return. It has to do with investors and all those types of things. So in my meetings, I used to literally just write down vocabulary words that I would have to go look up later. And when I started my career, that was the best thing I could have done for myself, of just, instead of interrupting or, you know, even showcasing that I didn't know what was going on, I did the homework to go figure it out. I always made sure that I kept myself educated and I was never in the dark. I always wrote things down and just figured it out later. But as I started to get into doing the things, all of a sudden there was so much context around these vocabulary words and I could start to use contextual clues to figure out other bigger concepts. I say the same things to our interns who start with us. If you come and intern with me, we actually have a mentorship program, and our interns get to participate in some of the marketing activities and in exchange they're mentored by me. And I say to them, I'm going to tell you all of this information, right? Copious notes. You're not going to know what any of it means. But in 6 weeks, when I give you an assignment, you have these notes, you will reference back and boom, the lightning goes off and you have that aha moment. And that thing that I told you about, which had no context, all of a sudden now you can see how it works in practice and it helps you learn so much more quickly. Sidebar, that's my number one rant about college, is I really feel my experience in college and what I'm still seeing a lot of happening out there is that all that you learn in college is theory. It's memorization, it's case studies, but there isn't any practical application. If you're just memorizing things for a test and there's no connection or anchor to anything that you've experienced in your life, it's so much easier to forget the information and it makes it totally not valuable. I remember when I was a kid, my dad went through an MBA program. I was probably about 9 or 10. And it was a very interactive MBA program. It was an executive program, meaning that it was on the weekends. And meaning that I was small, I used to have to go to those classes with him quite a bit on the weekends. And I don't remember the exact topic they were learning about, but I believe it was project management. And as part of their coursework, what they had to do for understanding project management was they had to assemble a whole bunch of wooden toolboxes. So imagine a little box with a wooden handle, like dowel, that goes across the top. And they had to develop with the like dozen or so people in the class, number one, where they were sourcing the material, what was the cost, who's going to be using the drill press, who's going to be responsible for cutting the dowels into the right lengths, who is going to be doing the quality control, what happens when somebody cuts something wrong, how does that affect your overall pricing? And it was a very simple construction project, but it took a lot of manpower, brain power to figure out how you were going to put all those things together. And the fact that I was 9 or 10 years old and I went to the professor's, I think it was the professor's garage that weekend, and that was part of his teaching mechanism, was having these people come and make all of these toolboxes. And if I remember correctly, they then donated them to like a kids center or something for gardening tools. I don't remember the whole detail, but my point is this. I wasn't even involved in the project, and I remember the lessons of how you get everybody organized and how to plan a project and what to do to maintain it going through the process, and then what happens when things change. Again, learning something and having context to it is the biggest thing. So that's why this episode exists. We are going to relate all of these financial topics back to reality television. And I know my people are here. I know you're crazy just like me. You're watching Traders. You're watching, oh my gosh, I feel like we're in the golden age of television right now. We have Traders. We have Severance. We have White Lotus that just came back. We have Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. We have Summer House. We have Southern Charm. So much is happening on television to where I have a show to watch almost every night. And I love when I'm behind because I've been so busy this week. So tomorrow is going to be my rot day and I have like 5 shows I get to watch back to back to back. Like nothing is more satisfying. So that's what we're talking about today. But before we get into it, I have so much tea to spill. I have a housekeeping update. This is the official announcement and your official invitation to the Old Money Book Club. I am so excited for this. You guys had asked for it. It came up in the cash consciousness group of should we do a book club together? Because I really feel there's so much opportunity for us to continue to learn together outside of what we're talking about on the show. And I had suggested a couple of books, some of which I had already read, and I put a poll on Instagram. And very gratefully for me, and maybe I influenced the outcome a little bit, I said, hey, there's one book on this list I haven't read yet. I just bought it. It just came out. It's brand new. I'm on chapter 2. I like it so far. And that was the book that y'all voted for. So we are going to start a book club. To join the book club, you can join by going to the Old Money Country Club. And there is now a section in the Old Money Country Club called Book Club, where you can go in and I will be dropping some questions, some ideas, some resources, and we will follow up by doing a little bit of a discussion for this book, which is, drumroll please, How to Win at Travel by the points guy, Brian Kelly. I am so excited to read this because not only does Brian Kelly have more travel experience than probably any other human on earth, this book is full of storytelling, but also practical advice on everything from how to find the cheapest flights, how to leverage hotel and credit card loyalty programs, how to beat jet lag, and how to score free flights and upgrades. The Old Money lifestyle, our lifestyle, the philosophy that we carry here at the podcast is that this show is not just about how to earn money, keep money, invest money, save money. It's how we can spend our money, how we can enjoy our life, where we can find wealth outside of the numbers in our bank account. And I truly, wholly believe that Travel is one of the most enriching experiences. I have learned so much, grown so much, gained so much from traveling, and I'm a huge proponent of it. But the costs to do it at market rate are insane. Like, I liked traveling back when there was a $39 Southwest flight option. And now when you're looking at flights, you're looking at hotels, the prices are just so insane. Not to mention that as I've gotten older and as I've experienced more and more elevated, luxurious experiences, my standards have continued to grow and grow, and I want better and better and fancier and more unique and more exclusive and all the things. So I'm really excited to dive into this book. I'm really excited to read it with you all. And I want to say this, there are so many amazing travel advisors, hello travel family, in this podcast audience. Mostly because my friend Jennifer, who is one of the co-founders of this incredible company called Teak, if you are a travel advisor, you need to talk to them. This is just the episode for commercials for all my friends. But she and I had, well, I had a podcast interview on her show, and a lot of that audience came over here. And I want to honor you all and give you all a space to connect as well as Rich Girls. So this book club specifically, the space specifically in the Old Money Country Club, is going to be our travel space where we can share what we're up to, where we're going, where we've gotten good deals. I'm going to be participating in it. I am planning a massive trip right now that I cannot wait to tell you all about. That's all on points. And the way I am hacking the system, I'm going to keep you updated every step of the way in the Old Money Country Club. So I'll put the link in the show notes. If you have not yet joined, what are you doing? Like, come hang out with us in there. There's a bunch of rich girls. There's people that have introduced themselves. It's up to y'all to connect with each other, find people who live in your area, have some IRL rich girl meetups. That's what the community is for. So one more time, the book is How to Win at Travel. The author is Brian Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, How to Win at Travel. And I cannot wait to talk to you all in the Old Money Country Club about how we're getting upgraded faux free. It has been a long time coming. You asked, I delivered. You guys, the merch store is finally open. It took such a long time to perfect these two products, but I felt like if we were going to tell people and brag about the fact that we're in the Old Money Country Club, we better get it right. So after doing an extensive vote on Instagram, thank you for everyone who participated, we have the most comfortable, coziest, warmest, thickest, most luxurious Old Money Varsity sweatshirts. They come in two colors, maroon and forest green, have a huge, beautiful Varsity Old Money logo right across the front so people know where you went to university. And they're oversized, so they're meant to be worn super loose, super comfortable. They're so warm, I can't get over it. But I think they're really cute because you can kind of style them up with some like gold earrings or just your everyday leggings. And of course, we have the Overserved at the Old Money Country Club hats that come in three colors. We have maroon, navy, and green. And these are super cute adjustable caps. They're perfect for your hot girl walks or the days where you just can't swing a hair wash. Everything is available for you at oldmoneypodcast.com/shop. I'll put the link in the show notes. And through the end of February, use the code INSTA, I-N-S-T-A, to get 15% off, I-N-S-T-A. These are limited edition offerings. I'm not going to make these again. So once they're gone, they're gone. I'm already running low on some of the green sweatshirts. So if you've been waiting, don't wait because we're going to run out of different sizes. Again, it's oldmoneypodcast.com/shop. Use the code INSTA, I-N-S-T-A, like Instagram, for 15% off. I love you guys so, so much and cannot wait to see you in your merch. Make sure you tag me at Old Money Podcast on Instagram so I can repost you. oldmoneypodcast.com/shop. Okay, my loves, let's get into it. We're talking everything Bravo related today. This is what you came for. This is what you're here for. I want to start off by level setting on salaries. I find this to be so incredibly fascinating. And the salaries to me more so interesting than who is the wealthiest housewife, which we'll also talk about. But the salaries for me, especially on these, what I call junior shows, Vanderpump Rules, Summer House, Southern Charm, they feature younger people, right? This was 20s to 30s. Now they're getting into 40s, whereas Housewives was starting in late 30s, 40s as their kind of demographic. And It's definitely a different vibe on all of these shows, but I think what's really interesting is the variability on salaries when most of these junior level stars don't have other wealth yet. Like the kids that show up on Southern Hospitality or season one of Vanderpump Rules, they were working truly as waitresses and hostesses and bartenders. And making this type of money was absolutely life-changing versus Alisa Vanderpump, who showed up to Real Housewives of Beverly Hills already independently wealthy. So there's a different type of golden handcuff situation happening here, right? Obviously, everybody loves a paycheck, but there was a different level of depravity and just commitment to being insane. When you look back at some of these earlier seasons of Vanderpump Rules, Summer House, Southern Charm, maybe Southern Charm wasn't like depraved, but you get my point. So let's go through some of the estimated salaries. Vanderpump Rules stars earn significantly more than the stars on Summer House and Southern Charm. Starting with the per season estimated salaries, and this is just all by research, we don't have these confirmed, but the OG cast, I'm talking about the people who started out on the show, Stassi, Jax, Tom Sandoval, Sheena, Katie, they were all making between $25,000 to $50,000 per episode. Whereas you compare that to a James Kennedy or a Raquel or an Ally, you're looking at between $10,000 and $25,000 per episode. And then, of course, Lisa Vanderpump, you would be seeing her make $50,000 per episode because she is the executive producer and the brain of the show, right? She's like the nucleus, so it all revolves around her. Even though, think about how little she has to film. She doesn't have to share anything intimate about her lives. She just gets to swoop in, dive in, be the boss, and then bounce. I will say, though, in comparison to Southern Hospitality, which I haven't really gotten into, and if I need to watch that, somebody can let me know. But I'm so shocked that they made a whole show revolving around Leva. I understand that she's also a restaurateur like Lisa Vanderpump, but she lacks that X factor that Lisa Vanderpump has. Like, we're not getting any mic drop one-liners from Leva in a confessional like we were getting from the cheeky British humor of LVP. So overall, for the Vanderpump Rules cast, they were making between $500,000 and $800,000 per season, especially as they became more senior in the show, because every single year you get a raise, right? So if you started on Vanderpump Rules like Ally in season, I don't know, 10 or whatever it was, she doesn't have the longevity or the seniority, so she's going to come in and make $10,000 per episode, whereas Lala is probably making $50,000 because she was one of the most senior members on the cast at that time. Now, Vanderpump Rules, I believe, has been on as the longest. Maybe Southern Charm is right behind it. But compared to Summer House, it's a totally different ballgame. Because when you look at the OG cast of Summer House, Kyle, Lindsay, Carl, Amanda, Paige, they're making between $10,000 and $20,000 per episode. Whereas newer cast members like Ciara, Gabby, West, Jesse, Solomon, they could be making as little as $4,000 to $10,000 per episode. So overall in a season, you're looking at $150,000 to $300,000 per season. The crazy thing is about this, though, is that they only film on the weekends. And they film, they're actually friends, so that I think makes a big difference. But they only film on the weekends. They get to go to set. They don't have cameras in their house. There's a much shorter filming season, I believe. I feel like they stretch out each day of the weekend into like one episode. And what has been really interesting is people are asking questions like, why is Paige DeSorbo still on the show? She's making so much other money. Like, kudos to her and Hannah. I just saw them, they were doing the Vanity Fair, maybe it was Oscar after party, pre-show, something like that. They're working with Vanity Fair. They're working with huge brands. They're touring and selling out huge stadiums, arenas, like Madison Square Garden. And I'm just like so happy to see two girls being girls doing really well. Do you know what I'm saying? And she's making a ton of money from brand deals and TikToks and Giggly Squad. But why would she just walk away from an extra $300,000 per season when the job is she goes to the Summer House for the weekend, which she would probably do anyway. She's there with her friends like Amanda and Ciara, right? And then she fucking stays in bed all weekend, you guys. Like, Who would say no to that? Like, does she bring a lot of drama to the show? Well, maybe we get a little bit later. We do, because of the whole Craig Conover thing. We'll talk about Craig. We'll talk about Craig and Summer House in a little bit. But my point is this, it's streams of revenue. So of course she's going to stick around. I would if I were her. Now compare this to Southern Charm. This is comparable to Summer House, but here we see that longevity really pays off. Now, interestingly, did you guys know that Whitney, the son of Pat Altishall, which is a name I don't know how to say, he's an executive producer and was the one that pitched the show to Starz. So he is so fucking weird, you guys. Like his guitars, he's always like hungover and he's just there. He's older than the cast, but not as old as Pat. I do not understand his role here. And it's like, I don't know what they actually think about him. I would love to know what they actually think about him. He used to kind of be in the mix. Remember when he was kind of hooking up with Naomi after her and Craig broke up? That was fucking weird. But he does bring some connection to Miss Pat in the show. And I think that she is the Greek chorus, the one who can say the things that no one else can say and get away with. And she also hosts the backdrop of what the show started as, which was, you know, supposed to be high society in the Deep South. If you remember some of the earlier seasons, they always concluded with some sort of ball or charity event. When we had the Thomas Ravenel, which I'm happy he's gone, by the way, but he was a state senator, granted a crestfallen, I think that's the wrong word. He was a disgraced senator. That's a better word, because he was disgusting. But to have somebody of such notoriety and the deep roots on the show, I think it has kind of devolved in the last few years. We don't see them out and about in Charleston. They're always in their homes. They're doing their cute little getting ready, hosting people. I don't want to spend one more minute of my time in that rental space that JT owns and his depressing ass apartment. That is not what I want from reality TV. Like, please take him off my screen. Like, I would be happy to never see him again or anything that's related to him. However, when we're talking about salaries here, we're looking at the OG cast like Shep and Craig and Austin, even though he wasn't OG, I think now he's part of the OG crew. Patricia, they're making between $15,000 and $25,000 per episode. So a little bit higher than Summer House, but they also have more of a filming requirement, right? The filming is looking like it's a little bit more constant. They're in their homes. It's a little bit more involved as it relates to scheduling and all the things that they have to do and attend to. They're traveling for the show. Summer House, they're never going anywhere but the Summer House, right? Some of the newer cast members like Sally or Molly or even probably Taylor, Olivia last season, they were making between $5,000 and $12,000 per episode. I'm wondering what Shep's non-girlfriend is getting paid for this season. And I want to dive into this for 1 second. I know we're going to talk about money, but sidebar. And sidebar to the sidebar, this might have to be 2 episodes because I can't shut up about Bravo and we have a lot to cover. So stay tuned for part 2, perhaps. Anyway, this whole thing with the new girlfriend, Shep, okay, you will be caught up if you have not watched this last week's episode. Like, this episode is dropping on a Tuesday. So if you have not watched last week's Southern Charm episode, the way that I was cackling at Austin when he was talking about Shep's text message and how he wanted to evaporate into the Bahamian atmosphere, I also felt so much secondhand embarrassment for Shep, and I feel like he is betwixt. He has been, I don't know, overtaken by the beauty of this girl. He has never acted like this, and it is the most uncomfortable thing to see when he wrote that text message and said, when I heard it from your freckled little lips, I wanted to retch. It is so cringe to watch. But what I love about what she's doing, and her name is escaping me right now. It is, hold on, let me think. Not Ciara, it's Sierra. Sierra, not Ciara, it's Sierra. She is quite a businesswoman because we all see what's probably happening here. And I know there's some drama on TikTok, but you guys, I'm not on TikTok anymore, so I don't know what's going on there. But she being Miss Bahamas, your whole job is to be a spokesperson for your country and promote tourism. So apparently, while this was airing on BravoTV.com, there were advertisements for Visit Bahamas. She brought the cast there to promote her country and encourage tourism. And I just could not be more impressed. So she might not be making anything per episode. She might be making a couple $1,000s per episode. But what she's doing for her other job, incredibly impressive. And that's kind of where I wanted to take this is I'm really impressed with a lot of the ingenuity and entrepreneurship that we've seen from these three casts. From Vanderpump Rules, we have all of like Stassi with her podcast. She was one of the very first. She's written a bunch of books. Although it was very failed, Tom and Tom, Sandoval and Schwartz, they were in business with TomTom and Schwartz and Sandy's. We're going to talk about that. Ariana and Katie with their sandwich shop. Sheena has a podcast. Lala has a podcast. Everybody has a podcast. You've seen the memes online that say we should make podcasting equipment more expensive. I hope you don't think that about me. Everybody has a podcast. You get a podcast, you get a podcast. But those are also very lucrative experiences for those people to have. And not to mention, when the Scandoval drama broke, everybody benefited because Lala would spill a little bit of tea, Sheena would spill a little bit of tea, and because their listenership went up and because they were getting picked up by Page Six and TMZ because Sheena said this one line about Tom or she said blah, 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 they probably had such an influx in downloads, meaning their ad spots were more valuable, meaning they were getting paid more to read ads, meaning everybody benefited. So while Scandoval was one of the most insane scandals that we've ever seen on Bravo TV, it was probably also one of the most acutely lucrative things that has ever happened for a cast. Now, I don't know whatever happened to The Valley because I was into it the first season. And if anybody's heard any rumors about when it's coming back, please send me a DM because I am waiting with bated breath to see Brittany Rotten Hail and Jack's back on my TV screen. Last season was so crazy. I'm not really sure that I care about Kristen's getting pregnant storyline. I don't want to see Sheena and Lala on The Valley. But again, this spinoff, this ingenuity, and the way that people are like, these kids don't stop hustling, right? Kyle with Loverboy, Lindsay with her influencing, Carl with not influencing. Amanda finally got her swimsuit line off the ground. We already talked about Paige and of course Hannah Berner, who was unceremoniously basically dumped by the show thanks to Kyle Cook and now has an incredibly thriving comedy career and also Giggly Squad. And then Southern Charm, we've seen some hits, some misses. Quite frankly, I think the most successful person to come out of Southern Charm is Craig with his pillows situation. Like, Sewing Down South has such a pull from a tourist perspective, from a Bravo economy perspective, and he's probably doing pretty well for himself. And even though Austin's whole Trop Hop beer, I mean, I don't think it's gotten anywhere close to national distribution or, I guess the goal for him would be to be purchased by another microbrewery, right? I don't know, maybe looking for an exit. But it's funny because on the show when he was launching it maybe 1 or 2 years ago, I feel like he was always ordering it, which was great, great exposure for the brand every time they went out to a bar. Because all these people do is go to these breweries and eat fried foods. And I'm so jealous, like sit in the sun, eat and drink. Anyway, he did really good at getting a lot of exposure for Trop Hop, but of recent season, am I wrong in saying that Austin's been ordering other beers off the menu? Or maybe they're not going to bars where Trop Hop is? Or maybe is Trop Hop not being distributed anymore? If anybody has tea, please send me a message because I will share on social. But I'm really curious to know. It's good entrepreneurial experience nonetheless. Like even if it didn't go anywhere, I always say even if it went a little bit and you did something, he built something. He started distribution in a company and a brand and that is really, really valuable. So I'm impressed regardless of where it ended up. And then of course we have Lovesick Shep, who actually is old money. Shep actually comes from a very prestigious line all through South and Appalachia area, as I understand it. And he is one of the people who has refamiliarized us with the term mailbox money. He is absolutely living off of a trust fund. He's never really had to work, as we've seen. He gets to live that playboy lifestyle, which gives us a little bit of Peter Pan syndrome. But he has different motivations. He doesn't need to be entrepreneurial. So just to kind of wrap it up, I think one of the things that we're learning from all of these shows, the junior level shows, is that side hustles matter. Many of these people are making more from the businesses that they start, from the brand deals that they have, from the social media presence. And it's not about the paycheck they're getting on the show. It's what they're doing to springboard off of the exposure that they get. And so if I was going to distill this into a lesson, it is that you've got to strike while the iron's hot. You have got to make sure you control your reputation, because if you're like Tom Sandoval and go through a scandal, your business is going to go to absolute shit, which we'll talk about in just a second. But my goodness, I think that it's just about looking for other opportunities and being entrepreneurial. And the other piece of this too, which I would be remiss if I did not mention, is the opportunity. Again, you see I'm using the word opportunity, entrepreneurial mindset. It's like looking and recognizing where you are and the opportunity, strike while the iron's hot. Like I was talking about with Austin, what can you do for your exposure? If you're going to be on reality TV, if you're going to go onto a podcast, if you're going to be, I don't know, walking around your city, maybe you want to wear a t-shirt that has the brand of your business on it so that you can promote your work. When we talk about promotion of businesses on these different TV networks, every single person has Bethany Frankel to thank for the money they make in their business exposure. So the first thing I want to talk about, which is not necessarily a complicated financial term, but it is a legal term that is called the Bethany Clause. And the Bethany Clause is a term that's been coined in the industry because Bethany Frankel is the one that struck down a very common practice that was really about networks benefiting off the backs of the people that were on their show. So there was at one time a provision in everybody's contract that granted the television networks, so in this case Bravo, a specific percentage of profits for a TV personality's private business that was promoted on screen. So going back to the very early days of Real Housewives of New York, we saw Bethany start her business, Bethany Bakes, if you can remember. And then if you can remember, Alex McCord created the most hideous logo I've ever seen in my life for Skinny Girl, which was Bethany's brand. But by the way, everybody starts somewhere. Bethany started slinging cookies in a grocery store, helping people find the sliced ham. You have to start somewhere. And if you're not embarrassed from the first things that you did, well, girl, I guess we just have nothing in common, because some of the early stuff that I did is, oh, cringe. I have no idea. But anyway, she caught this provision in her contract and she struck it out. She negotiated with Bravo because she said, if I go on Real Housewives of New York, I'm going to keep full ownership and profits from anything that I create. Because of her very shrewd, and I don't mean that in a negative term, but very, very sophisticated note, and I'm glad she read her contract, she went from making $7,250 in her first season, the whole season of Real Housewives of New York, to retaining millions of dollars when she sold her brand Skinny Girl for what is estimated to be over $100 million. She did not owe any percentage to Bravo. If she would not have inputted the Bethany Clause, which allowed her to retain all of the profits and all of the benefit of her business without giving any back to Bravo, she would have had to pay big, big bucks. So what can we learn from Bethany Frankel? Read your contracts before you sign them. Get a lawyer to review your contracts, because the Bethany Clause not only set precedent for her, it set precedent for every single other reality star on the network to retain the benefits of their business. Now, is Bravo an evil entity for trying to steal money from the people that are on their show promoting their products? No. I mean, if you think about it, it actually does make sense. I'm giving you this platform. I'm fronting the cost for production. You're just talent, right? I'm fronting the cost for promotion. You're just talent. If you want to come on my network in my house and promote your thing, I can charge you for the benefit of doing that. It's advertising cost, right? Well, you're not going to ask your talent to pay you to advertise on the show. So usually the deal that would be struck would be, since you're not going to pay me for the privilege of advertising here, I will instead take a cut of your profits after you sell what you advertise. Do you see what I mean? So it's not like Austin can afford to buy a commercial for Trop Hop to run during the commercials of Southern Charm. So he's going to use product placement to promote his products on his own show. Well, think of it this way. If you wanted to do product placement on a show on Bravo, that's still going to cost you a pretty penny. So it doesn't make sense for Bravo to just be giving away advertising for free, right? So that's why they had that written in. But Bethany argues that that's a part of my storyline. If you want to see my real reality, my life is that I'm building a business. And by the way, there's no guarantee that it takes off. If you look at Sonia Morgan, she got the exact same opportunity that Bethany Frankel did to promote anything that she wanted to promote. She ended up choosing to promote a toaster oven. So it didn't work out so well for her. But fortunately for Bethany, it worked out very lucratively for her. And she got to keep all of the proceeds of her sale. So mazel tov, Bethany. And it's actually a perfect segue for us to take a slight left turn to talk about the more senior level shows on Bravo, which are The Housewives, the creme de la creme, the cornerstone, the OGs, and I'm not just talking about Vicky Gunvalson. I want to talk about who the wealthiest housewives are, and the answers might surprise you. Now, I want to say this is all alleged. Take it with a grain of salt, because who actually knows what's in the bank accounts? So these are all, I don't know, estimates, but I think it helps us kind of keep things in perspective. Now, the lowest person on this particular list, which is not a comprehensive list of all housewives and all of their net worths, but I really like this person on this list, starting from the lowest amount. And this person was certainly rich before they came on the show, or as they like to say, I am very rich, bitch, before they came on the show. But their millions were truly earned through their appearances on Real Housewives, plus what they parlayed into after, which was acting, hosting, comedy, brand endorsements, and business ventures that all stemmed from the show. She was already opposed to white refrigerators before she got her wealth. NeNe Leakes at the bottom of our list from Real Housewives of Atlanta. $14 million net worth. That is incredibly impressive. And you have got to respect the hustle of somebody who, like I said, she was wealthy before, but she was not $14 million wealthy before she came on Real Housewives of Atlanta. There's no way. So she has really done well for herself. And again, she's just banked on her personality. I love a personality hire. And quite frankly, there hasn't been a better one than NeNe on all seasons and all franchises. So I like to see her here. Moving up on the list here, we have what I like to call a junior housewife. Like, she was definitely part of core storylines, but she was never really anchored as an OG on the show. But this particular person is an heiress. She's old money, and she is East Coast old money. This person was known before being on the show as being a socialite, and that is a very clear indicator to me that this person was living off of family wealth. And that is true. Tinsley Mortimer, who clocks in at $35 million net worth, according to this article, inherited a fortune from her parents and grandparents. Tinsley's father was a real estate investor. Her grandfather founded Mercer Rug Cleansing in 1936. And then, of course, she had a very public divorce from her husband, Topper, which, if we're just judging a book by our cover here, Topper is wearing penny loafers and some salmon-colored shorts and a polo and those sunglasses hanging around his neck. And a name like Topper, I don't know. You know he comes for money too. So I'm sure she had a bit of a win from that divorce settlement. And that marks the first of many women who amassed their wealth through marriage, or probably more appropriately to say, through divorce. Speaking of a character we've always already touched on today, Pat, Miss Pat from Southern Charm. Her net worth is estimated to be at $50 million. I wonder how much of that is the equity in her home, because that home is absolutely insane. Let's look it up. Pat Southern Charm house worth. Okay, according to this article, the historic Isaac Jenkins Mickle House is estimated to be worth around $15 million. She bought the home in 2008 for $4.8 million. So good for her. She 3X'd her investment. It's a historic home, and she is also a former Manhattan socialite, and she also had a home with her late husband, Arthur Altishul. I don't know how to say that name, you guys. It was a 30-room mansion in Long Island, and they sold it in 2009 for $12.5 million. So again, her net worth is estimated at this time to be around $50 million. And what's really interesting is recently came out that she sold her home, the Isaac Jenkins Mickle House, to her son, Whitney, the executive producer on Southern Charm, to put it in a trust for him. So really interesting. I'm not sure of the details, but if you haven't listened to the Protect Yourself Legacy episode that I released a couple weeks ago, I talk a lot about wills and trusts and probate, and it's really interesting to see her kind of preparing for what to do with these assets as she moves on. But the funny thing about Miss Patricia is that she is probably the most vocal woman on the show, interested in judging other women for their choices, yet she's been married 3 times, and that is actually how she amassed most of her wealth. She was married and divorced to Whitney's father. They divorced in 1979. Then she was married to a psychiatrist and entrepreneur who founded the Psychiatric Institute of Washington from 1989 to 1995. And then her third husband passed away in 2002, and he was a billionaire and former partner at Goldman Sachs. He was also a philanthropist and art collector. And so, of course, when he passed, his wealth moved on to her. So maybe she didn't get it through divorces. Maybe she was a widow. Maybe it was true love. But here's the thing, Miss Patricia. I'm not going to judge you for being married 3 times. Maybe you're just the type of woman who falls in love very easily. And so maybe also are some of the young women on your show. And so maybe you have more in common with them than you think. Pot, kettle, black, black, black. Anyway, moving on to the next one. I went slightly out of order because I don't believe this estimate to be true. I think that this woman is worth far more than it's reported on this article. And I also respect the hell out of this woman because she is self-made. And the reason why I question what they comment her net worth is, they say $30 million on this particular estimate. But this person is a Grammy-winning songwriter and producer and is behind the scenes of so many huge songs and artists, including all of the Destiny Child songs like No Scrubs and Bills, Bills, Bills. She has a TV production company. She is a hustler. Her name is Candy Burris. And this article says she's worth $30 million, but I would put her net worth between $30 and $50 million. And respect, because again, it's all self-made. Her talent is insane, and she really has, in my opinion, struggled recently with her brand. All of this sex toy business and YouTube channels and all of these other things that she's done to hustle for money, for me, have really devalued her, I would say, not her net worth, but her social worth. It feels like she's a little scattered and doing a lot of low-dollar projects, even opening up this restaurant empire, Old Lady Gang, which I actually hear is very successful and yummy, according to Reddit. But the thing is that if she just stuck to music and kept producing music, don't you think that would be like more bang for your buck? Like, you're talented, you're in your zone of genius, just keep writing great songs for great artists and stay focused on that in order to really win at your game. That is a perfect example of zone of genius. Like, we know where her talent is. She's so incredible. So I don't know if she's hustling. Maybe I'm taking back what I say. Maybe it's not between 30 and 50 million. I mean, I think that because who knows what like records she owns or masters she owns or royalty she's getting from songs. I just think that for me, I think of that as being like such, think about how many times you've heard the song No Scrubs. My God, like, does she get a royalty every time they play it? That's where I think. But then at the same time, I'm rethinking what I was thinking, because why is she hustling with all these random projects? Like, gotta maintain the brand and keep it highbrow. Do you know what I mean? Anyway, back to another one of our divorcees. Also from the state of Georgia, but not on Real Housewives of Atlanta, like our girl Candy. This particular socialite, has the most incredible divorce settlement I've ever heard of in my life. In fact, according to her, not just reports, according to her, she is getting a tidy sum of $300,000 per month for her divorce settlement. This person is Sutton Strack on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. For her children, her ex-husband also had to pay $50,000 every month in child support. They had three children together. I believe all of them are above 18 now, which means that he wouldn't need to pay child support at this point. But he had also set up trusts for their children of $3 million and was adding to it over time. They had a ton of art that they had to split, a ton of real estate in the divorce. But what I thought was so interesting about this is that despite her always acting holier than thou, Sutton actually committed the number one housewives crime that everybody judges people for. It just so happened to work out positively in her favor. And the crime she committed was putting her head in the sand with her finances. When she was on Watch What Happens Live like 5 years ago, she told Andy that she did not know anything that was happening in the financial aspect of her marriage because he was in charge. And when they were divorced, she was surprised to learn that she owned a part of a minor league baseball team and a timber company. Like, can you imagine just divorcing and being like, oh, how about that? We own a baseball company or baseball team and a timber company. I mean, that's crazy. So thank goodness that her husband wasn't a Joe Giudice character who was having her sign paperwork and screwing her out of all the money. They actually had assets to separate when they got divorced. So not only did they split their art collection and their real estate, she got a lump sum and this $300,000 a month alimony payment. Three vehicles, kept all of her jewelry, couture, her clothing, Andy Warhol art, a bank account, all of this stuff. So, you know, she's pretty freaking comfortable. And yet, she really does focus in this season on wanting to get respect around what she built with her store, with her clothing store. And I really understand that. I think especially for somebody who, for the majority of their life, especially raised by a mother like her mother, Reba, if you guys are watching this, oh my gosh, right? If you're raised by a mother like that and not getting a lot of positive affirmation or feedback and you accomplish something that you never had to do before, she didn't have to work. She still doesn't have to work, but she did something for herself and she wants some appreciation for it. Like, Sutton's love language is words of affirmation, that's for sure. And I really resonate with that. And I have sympathy for the fact that she hasn't gotten the support that she wants from her mother. And I think it's really interesting, her journey, but also the way that she's so freaking judgmental when at the end of the day, she wasn't involved in all of the finances and investments in these baseball teams and timber companies. That was clearly all being handled by her husband, and she got to be on the lucky end of that stick versus what we normally see, like an Erica Girardi case on Real Housewives. I don't know if I mentioned this, but according to this article, her net worth is set at $50 million, which is higher than her friend that she just brought on the show, Jennifer Tilly. According to the internet, she has a net worth of $40 million, but it's another story of a divorce settlement. This is an interesting one because Jennifer Tilly was married to the co-creator of The Simpsons. Of course, you know Jennifer Tilly from acting and Chucky and all these other 90s movies, but that's not how she got wealthy. She actually got wealthy through this very sophisticated divorce settlement, which was, as a part of her divorce, she received a piece of The Simpsons. Have you heard of it? It's just the longest running animated series of all time. And so she getting a part of the ownership of The Simpsons means that she was always going to receive a cut of the profits. She has the equity and the ownership and the profits. Unfortunately, her ex-husband passed away from cancer in 2015, but she talks about it very openly on the show that she thanks Simon all of the time for what he gave her, which is honestly the majority of her wealth. And she has a very interesting spending profile compared to some of the other women on the show, right? I actually watched an interesting documentary. It's on Amazon and it's all about Tiffany, the brand Tiffany, and she's interviewed in it. She's one of Tiffany's best customers and she actually collects jewelry. She has an insane jewelry collection, but she also, as you've seen on the show, will collect odd handbags like that Louis Vuitton boat, the ship that she was carrying as a purse. She has very ostentatious fashion, very avant-garde, but it feels different than a Bronwyn, right? A Bronwyn who's very tapped into the fashion. I'm talking about Bronwyn from Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. Bronwyn was just in the New York Times style section. Bronwyn was always at, it has been even before Housewives, at all of these fashion shows and fashion weeks and all the things. But Jennifer Tilly's spending profile to me feels a little chaotic. Like she just has a lot of things that like, ooh, make her happy. And doesn't that just feel like her vibe? She's just like very much like a magpie, like shiny object syndrome, which I'm not hating on it at all. It's just such a different spending profile than some of the other people on the show who might even have a higher net worth than her. I'll come back to Real Housewives of Beverly Hills in 1 minute, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention our girl, Bethany Frankel, Real Housewives of New York, $80 million net worth estimated. She sold Skinny Girl cocktails for $100 million, but retained the branding rights. But in addition, she's a hustler, as she'll tell you. Not only is she selling you drugstore makeup and cosplaying to be a middle-class person on TikTok every single day, she has her real estate, all the flipping that she did when she was partnering with Frederick from Douglas Elliman on all these shows. By the way, I've met Frederick in person at the Douglas Elliman offices in New York City. And when I tell you, he's the most beautiful human. He's 100 feet tall, so tan, brightest teeth, super bright eyes, eye contact, locked you in. And then, hello, so nice to meet you. Softest hands, wonderful person for the 5 seconds that I met him in the lobby. But my point is this, Bethany is a hustler. And the thing that I appreciate the most about Bethany, regardless of how obnoxious she is on TikTok, how much you hated her on Real Housewives of New York, I always liked her. I always have had a very soft spot in my heart for her because of her work ethic. I cannot say enough good things about her philanthropic efforts and what she has started with Be Strong and Global Empowerment Mission. This started as, this is a crisis and how can I help? And she was one of the first during some of the major hurricanes and floods, especially out of our country in Haiti and Puerto Rico, of going and freaking logistically organizing, getting supplies to people on the ground, resourcing all of her wealthy friends and hiring planes to go deliver supplies, going there herself, passing out gift cards to people so that they could, with dignity, buy the things they need versus digging through piles of donated trash that people are sending. Like this whole thing with the LA fires, people are like, I'm going to donate my clothes. And then they send nasty old out of fashion clothes that have been worn to death. And yes, of course, these people do need immediate things, but it's just like a dignity issue to give people the opportunity to buy the type of baby formula that they need or the type of diapers that they use. And not to mention that, it also helps to revitalize the local economy. So instead of just shipping a bunch of stuff in from out of the area, what we have to focus on as well is revitalizing the businesses that have been impacted in the areas that are lost. And how can we continue to pump money into the local businesses so that they can also rebuild and sustain themselves after a tragedy? So again, I'm going to be a Bethany Frankel apologist until the end of my days, because what she has done with her philanthropic efforts to me makes her the most superior housewife. Okay, now back to the West Coast, and 1, 2, and 3, or 3, 2, and 1, as I will tell you about them, are all from the same series, but you are never going to remember who number one is. Just wait till we get there. However, we have to talk about the family that is falling apart, Kyle and Mauricio, Umansky, Richards, whatever. Kyle, as you know, is the sister of Kathy Hilton. Kathy Hilton is married to Rick Hilton, who is the son or the grandson, I'm not really sure, of Conrad Hilton, the founder of the Hilton Hotel chain. Now, just a sidebar, if you've ever seen that episode of Mad Men where Dawn and Betty go to Italy, it's one of the best episodes of TV ever. I love it so much. And they go to stay in that Hilton Hotel. That man, he to me is the real Conrad Hilton. I don't know who the real Conrad Hilton is, but it was that actor on Mad Men for sure. Anyway, Rick Hilton started a real estate company called Hilton and Highland, and Mauricio used to work for Rick Hilton at Hilton and Highland. However, according to reports, this is all, I just want you guys to know, I'm just spitballing this. I just have this knowledge in my soul. I'm not reading from anything. I just know this shit. That's unhealthy. Anyway, according to reports, Mauricio went to Rick after Hilton and Highland had had their most successful year in sales volume ever. And according to Mauricio, he was like 20% contribution to that, meaning he did, what, $200 million in real estate on his own. And as a one person on the team that contributed 20% of the total sales volume, plus he was by marriage brother-in-law with Rick Hilton, he said, I'd like to be a partner in this firm. I'd like equity. Like, I'm one of the biggest contributors. He's saying, like, I want to become a partner of this company. Like, basically, let me in. And Kyle and her sister, Kathy, are the ones that are kind of working behind the scenes. And essentially, Rick says, no. Rick says, I'm not going to make you a partner. So Mauricio goes to Kyle and says, well, this might cause a lot of drama with your family, but, like, I need to advance my own career and I need to start my own business. And he obviously has never publicly said anything negative, Mauricio, about Hilton and Highland, because Kyle and Kathy are obviously still sisters and there's, you know, the whole family tie, but it really did affect the whole family dynamic and cause this huge falling out between Kyle and her sisters. So anyway, Mauricio goes on to found the agency, which opened, I think, 2011. And the reason I think that is because I graduated from school in 2009. And then this new company came on the market that I was aware of in LA. And I was trying to get a job to save my freaking life in real estate. It's a really tough time to start a new brokerage in real estate. And by the time I was interviewing at my last company, which I believe was in 2014, I had brought to my interview a section from the New York Times, and it was a cover image. It was an ad. It was a full page ad of the agency, and it said, not your grandfather's real estate agency. And I brought that to my meeting with my boss to be, who ended up being my mentor for the last 10 years. And I said, this is the way. We have to redefine real estate. It has to be modern real estate. All these old traditional brokerages are not sustainable anymore. All of these real estate agents think they're so traditional and fancy. It was the same time around Berkshire Hathaway had bought up Prudential Real Estate, and it was all very stodgy and boring. And this was one of the first companies. This was like right around the time also Compass was coming on board as a brokerage agency, especially in California. They had founded in New York first. But I said, this is the way. This is what it needs to be. It needs to be modern. I don't want to work with somebody that's my grandfather's real estate agent. Like, this brand gets it. And they've got it so good that if we compare now where the agency is, the agency has more than 50 offices across the world and over 800 real estate agents working for their brand, compared to Hilton and Highland, which has one office in Beverly Hills and 90 realtors working for them. So if you compare just by volume, obviously the agency is crushing Hilton and Highland. However, the Hiltons, Baron, Tessa, and Rick, have started their own new real estate brokerage called Hilton and Hilton with the mission to modernize the world of real estate. A luxury brokerage that launches with the goal of modernizing the real estate industry. Like, how? What are you doing? Is there technology? What are you doing differently? Because you're taking a picture and you're all wearing gray suits and you're in a traditional looking home and it doesn't look modern to me. You can't just slap a name or a word or a label and say, we're modern real estate or we're doing things differently, and then keep doing things the way you're doing them. What the agency did different is they branded different, they positioned different. I don't know if the services are any different, but it's definitely a testament to going out and striking to do something on your own. And because he did that, according to reports, Kyle and his net worth is at about $100 million. Very interesting. As we see these conversations evolve with Kyle on this season of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills about how she helped him build the business. I mean, my God, she got him his job at Hilton Highland, right? Through her connections, through her sister or whatever. I mean, really being at the beginning stages of that business, does Kyle have equity position in that business? 100%. It's a really interesting thing. And, you know, for the sake of love, I hope that they don't get divorced. I don't know that they're going to work it out. This might be a very interesting legal battle. as we see how these assets are divided, these global assets. I mean, this is a huge, huge deal. So interesting. We'll see how it unfolds on the next season of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I'm just kidding. Okay, last two on our list. And obviously, we haven't even gotten to any of the real estate concepts, or not the real estate, sorry, I'm in real estate world, any of the financial concepts yet and all the things that we need to talk about. So yes, this will be a two-part episode. However, the next person on our list is actually rated a little bit lower in net worth than Kyle, but here I go out of order. I'm sorry. This person, I've already talked about her, multiple restaurants and bars, profitable TV empire like Vanderpump Rules, other executive producer credits like Vanderpump Villa. She has multiple restaurants in Las Vegas now. She's franchised her name between Vanderpump Paris and Vanderpump Garden and all the other things. Obviously, I'm talking about Lisa Vanderpump of Vanderpump Pets, Vanderpump Rosé, Vanderpump Vodka. Oh my gosh. I'll have a vodka martini, please. Lisa Vanderpump clocks in at $90 million net worth. And really interesting the way that her evolution has unfolded and all of the things that she's gotten her fingers into, whether it's TomTom, Schwartz and Sandy's, something about her, all of her TV shows. I don't really have a lot to say about Lisa because she's honestly a pretty traditional entrepreneur. She's starting businesses, shutting them down when they no longer work, RIP Pump. But $90 million is not a bad place to be. So, our last person on the list, can you think of somebody who is wealthier than Kyle Richards and Mauricio Umansky or Lisa Vanderpump and Ken Todd? I could not think of his name for a second. Very interestingly, one of my most hated housewives of all time. She gave major grifter energy. She brought nothing to the show. Was licking her lips all of the time. You know who I'm talking about on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, Diana Jenkins, who, according to her profile online, is a Bosnian entrepreneur, philanthropist, and former model. But at her reported net worth of $300 million, do we really think that she made her fortune through Nuro drinks and real estate investments? I don't think so. I think that her nine-figure divorce settlement in 2009 definitely gave her a little bit of a boost. Now, I'm not here to take away any efforts that she's made in increasing or keeping that initial settlement, but to say that she has made her fortune through Nuro drinks is absurd. Have you guys ever had those drinks? I remember so specifically, they used to be sold at the Vons in La Jolla when I used to live across the street on Eads Avenue, and I'd walk through the alleyway over to Vons and get like a frozen pizza. And there were these Nuro drinks that promised that they were going to help you with your, I don't know, brain power function or your metabolism or whatever. And she was obviously sued for misrepresenting, not obviously, but just in case you didn't know, she was sued for misrepresenting the powers and benefits of these drinks. And quite frankly, I haven't seen them since then on stores. Interestingly, this is such a sidebar on a sidebar on a sidebar. We've talked about Bethany Frankel selling Skinny Girl for $100 million. We've talked about Diana Jenkins making this made-up money through these Nuro drinks. If you guys are fans of fitness influencers or have ever been in that space, I guarantee on Instagram you have known or seen the girl Katie Hearn. She is married to Hayden Schneider. She is not a housewife. This has nothing to do with Bravo. This is just breaking news from last week. They have a energy drink company called Alani Nu. As my best friend Alicia says, if you take any supplements from Alani Nu, you might want to murder your husband because they fucking jack you up on so much caffeine. It's insane. Those Alani Nu drinks are stronger than any Red Bull ever has ever been. And they have all of these flavors and they're fitness people and they do a great job promoting. Well, they have been one of the fastest growing energy drink brands over the last many years. It was just announced last week that they sold their company to Celsius for $1.8 billion. You guys, Bethany Frankel sold Skinny Girl for $100 million and retained branding rights, but Katie Hearn sold Alani Nu energy drinks for $1.8 billion. That's 18 times what Bethany Frankel sold for. I think I read something and I don't remember if it said 12 or 20X on the EBITDA, which is the earnings before interest, debt, and whatever, you know what I'm saying. But like, it's a huge multiplier, so to speak. And people are really banking on, or they're trying to explain it saying Celsius is banking on the brand equity, which they have built so much brand equity. In fact, sidebar on the sidebar on the sidebar. I was just looking at this influencer that I follow. It's like Champagne and Chanel or something like that. Emily Heron. She lives in Dallas, Texas. And I just think she has the cutest little house and dogs and whatever. She's pregnant right now. She was just posting what to pack in your hospital bag. And she didn't write energy drink. She wrote like pajamas and, you know, Mama Frida, whatever the fuck you need for when you give birth. And then she had blanket and sound machine and phone charger and Alani Nu. Like she named, like, bring Alani Nu, the brands, you're gonna need them when you give birth. Like that is crazy brand equity. But I've been following Katie Hearn and Hayden Schneider on Instagram for 10, 12 years now, since Instagram started, 2012 or whatever. And I had like a bit of a brain fart when that happened. When I read that, I was like not able to process my feelings about it all. I felt this weird parasocial relationship with them where I was like, oh my God, my friends just made $1.8 billion. Like nothing's ever going to be the same. You guys, I don't know them. They are not my friends. I have no idea. They do not know who I am. I just have followed them for so long. And it really was an opportunity for me to investigate what was coming up and journal around it. And what came up for me was that that is such a staggering amount of money to receive at one time in such a windfall of sudden wealth that I had never considered receiving a number that high before in my life. So it felt like something that was untrue or impossible or would change them in such a crazy way. I had never allowed myself to go to the dreaming portion of my destination in life of what would it look like if I received $1.8 million in a windfall. Granted, they're not walking away with $1.8 million. They have partners and investors and they have tons of other people to pay and investors and partners and taxes, of course. And so let's say at the end of a bad day, they walk away with $500 million. That is such a life-changing amount of money. I had realized that I felt uncomfortable with it because it was an amount of money that I had never really sat with and like allowed my nervous system to expand into or even think about. It just felt repulsive to me. It felt like that's too much, or what would you do, or how would I feel? I would feel paralyzed. I would feel crazy. I would feel what to do. Like it's unfathomable to me. So I've been working on that this week of like readjusting and attuning to what would it feel like to receive that amount of money. So that's just an aside on an aside on an aside. We are on the 50th off ramp of this highway, which is going to be another episode because we're already at over an hour of time on this episode today. So anyway, back to Diana Jenkins, the lick lipper that I cannot stand, $300 million net worth, which seems crazy unfathomable to me as well, which shows me I need to do some reflection around comfortability with those levels of wealth because that feels too far away from me. And I need to reacclimate myself, my brain, my thoughts, my vision, my nervous system with a higher and higher level of wealth. So let's wrap it up there. We talked about all of the salaries, all of the housewives. We have so much more to cover. On next week's episode, we're going to talk about all of the most dramatic things that have ever happened on the Bravo network that have to do with money and what we need to learn from them, whether it's a concept or a term or a new way to think about things. Let's get into it. So if you don't like Bravo and you just listen to this whole episode, I owe you a 5-star review on your podcast network, okay? Thank you for being here. If you're a Bravo person, please go leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Tell the people what they can find here. Tell the people that we're spilling the tea, and let's bring those Bravo fans into the club of rich girls we have over here at Old Money. I love you guys so, so much. Please share this episode on your Instagram stories. Tag me. Let's promote it. Let's get it out there. Let's talk all things Bravo. I love you so much, and I'll talk to you on the next episode. Bye-bye. Feeling rich? I hope so. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Old Money. If you have questions you want answered, email me at oldmoneypodcast@gmail.com or hit us up on social. We are at Old Money Podcast, and I am at your service. If this episode spoke to you, inspired you, helped you, if you took a single note, it would mean the world to me if you could please just take a minute to rate and review the podcast. And if you're not doing so already, subscribe. And if you have friends who like getting rich, please share this episode with them, even if it's just on your Instagram story. and I'd love you more than Jeff Bezos loves Amazon Prime. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you on the next episode. Remember, I'm not your lawyer, I'm not your tax professional, and I'm not your financial advisor. The content presented in this podcast is intended to entertain, educate, inspire, and support listeners in their personal and professional development and does not constitute business, financial, or legal advice. In addition to that, this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services.